Now, Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Ready for the spontaneous, unrehearsed conference are four of America's top news reporters. Their questions do not necessarily reflect their point of view, but maybe their way of getting a story. Now, here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Here in New York, the United Nations General Assembly has just adjourned another session, a session marked by increased tensions between East and West. Our guest today is the United States Ambassador to the UN, Henry Cabot Lodge. Ambassador Lodge has earned a reputation internationally for the speed and the vigor with which he has countered the vigorous attacks by the Soviet Union. He was chosen as our chief delegate soon after President Eisenhower took office, and he has been reappointed with each new assembly. He formerly served for 13 years in the United States Senate. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Ambassador Lodge, are Ernest Lindley of Newsweek magazine, Pauline Frederick of NBC News, Krishna Balaraman of the newspaper Hindu of India, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Mr. Ambassador, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Ambassador, in an interview last year which you gave to the Journal American, you said this: if the United Nations were to disappear today, it is clear to me that war would be impossible to prevent. Do you still believe that today?
Well, I think without the United Nations, the world would be a much more dangerous place. Much more dangerous place.
Well, that's changing it slightly.
Well, not very much.
In your judgment, has the United Nations made a major contribution towards peace during this past year?
I think the United Nations has made several major contributions towards peace during its existence. And I think during the last year, the United Nations played a very useful part in the Middle Eastern situation, beginning with the Lebanese crisis. And it can be said that in 58 it did play a major part for peace, yes.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, hasn't it really been the power of the United States and the network of mutual defense treaties which have kept the peace, if you can call what we have
peace?
Well,
I think, of course, the power of the United States is a big factor. But the resolution which the Arab countries introduced unanimously in September concerning the situation in Lebanon, which was a very helpful factor, cannot be attributed to the power of the United States. I think when that power is used in accordance with the only accepted conduct of behavior for governments, which is the United Nations Charter, then it's just that much more effective.
And you think that it wasn't the power of the United States in our mutual defense treaties, but the United Nations itself which made a contribution?
I think the United Nations made a contribution in addition to the contribution that we made, because we are part of the United Nations.
No, but I mean, if that power weren't there, the United Nations would have been absolutely helpless. Isn't that so?
Oh, yes. The United Nations only works to the extent that the members put up when the going gets rough. That's right. It's not a super state. It has no sovereignty.
Mr. Balaraman.
Mr. Ambassador.
It sets up a standard to which the wise and honest can repair, to use George Washington's phrase.
Mr. Ambassador, you said the other day the United Nations has been hamstrung by the fact that the Russians have been taking a Cold War approach to every issue and not missing a single opportunity to attack the United States. It seems to me, as a neutral Asian, that the United States too has tended to approach issues from the Cold War angle and to rake up well-known old Russian sores. When are we going to have a moratorium in the UN on this?
On what?
Moratorium on the Cold War, agreement on dropping Cold War approach inside the United Nations.
Well, I think, Mr. Balaraman, that I have never started one of these Cold War altercations. Now, when they start one, then, of course, naturally, I respond. And as long as I'm there, if the United States government, the United States is attacked, I'm going to defend it. But I have never started an altercation.
But can't some agreement be reached, a gentleman's agreement between the two countries not to approach...
I tried with Mr. Zorin over a period of several weeks to reach an agreement on the constitution of the new Outer Space Committee, and we made every attempt you can think of, and it didn't succeed.
Miss Frederick.
Mr. Ambassador, a little less than a year ago, you made a speech here in New York in which you said the hardest struggle we face today is not with the Soviet Union, but with ourselves, to make walking humbly and brotherly love a fact instead of a phrase. In the closing hours of this General Assembly, you criticized Russian intransigence for frustrating the United Nations General Assembly. What has happened in this less than a year to make you change your evaluation of what our greatest struggle is?
Well, there isn't any inconsistency there. I think that within the forum of the United Nations in the last 3 months of the General Assembly, Russian intransigence was the biggest obstacle. I think taking the broad view of all our foreign relations, the biggest single challenge we have is to live up to our own ideals. I think if we make a reality of the Declaration of Independence that says that all men are created equal, if we show that every man's civil rights are absolutely secure in this country, it would be the greatest thing that we could do to influence the minds of men all over the world.
But as far as the rights of other nations are concerned, take the Algerian question, for example. Many nations in the United Nations feel that there are many rights that the Algerian people do not have. Now, on the resolution merely calling for negotiations for peaceful settlement of the Algerian question, the United States did not say a word, either in committee or the General Assembly, and when the final vote came, we abstained. This obviously did not please France. It did not please the Afro-Asian group. Where are we extending our declaration of the rights of other people into our foreign relations when we take this kind of an
action? Well, what I meant was our own civil rights, things such as Little Rock, that type of incident, I think, do our foreign relations great harm. Now, when it comes to these questions to which you refer, that, of course, involves all sorts of other considerations.
Well, what was gained by a policy which did not satisfy the French, did not satisfy the other side? Is there anything positive?
There are a great many of these situations where you can't satisfy anybody, where the choice is between a broken arm and a broken leg, and you haven't got any other choice.
But isn't this important right now? The Soviet Union sided with those who wanted negotiations between the Algerians and the French, and right now with the adjournment of the conference in Accra of the African people who are saying that the imperialists must get out of Africa. Isn't it important for us to have a strong relationship with these people and to let them know that...
Oh, I think it is. I think it is. And to have good relations with the nations of Africa and the nations of Asia is vitally important for us. There isn't any question about that. And we certainly ought to do whatever we can. But sometimes you get questions that it's just impossible to satisfy people on.
Mr. Lindley.
Mr. Ambassador, you've been quoted as comparing Soviet behavior at this recent General Assembly with the days of Stalin and when Vyshinsky, the vituperative Vyshinsky, was representing the Soviet Union. Is that a solid judgment on your part?
I think that at this last session, the Soviet spokesmen have been just as bitter, as unreasonable, as contentious, as unwilling to face reality as they were in the days of Stalin.
Why, in your judgment, was that the case?
I wish I knew. I often think it's because they run a large part of their foreign policy in accordance with some ritual. And they think that a country that isn't a communist country has got to be their opponent. And so they attack us for that reason. I can't believe it represents a dispassionate evaluation of Russia's national interest, because I don't think we do threaten the Soviet
Union. Mr. Ambassador, who, in your judgment, on the basis of your long experience, directs Soviet policy today, foreign policy? Does Khrushchev do it? Does somebody else?
Oh, yes. I think I have the impression, just an impression, I can't prove it, I have the impression that Mr. Khrushchev is the boss.
How much latitude do the Soviet diplomats in the UN have, in your experience?
I have the impression that they're very closely controlled.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Ambassador, in your judgment, is there much hope for real Soviet cooperation towards world peace?
Well, I think that over the next 25 years, you're going to see an evolution in the Soviet Union. I'm quite optimistic over the long pull. I think as they educate more and more of their young people, the world is going to shrink. They can't keep up these iron curtains forever. And I would think that over the next 25 years, things might get better. But in the short view, I don't see any sign at all of a change from this attitude that they've got.
Since the Soviet defies so many of the UN Charter proposals, why do you think they remain in the UN? Why do you think they're there at all?
Well, I think they're like the lady who doesn't dare leave the bridge party for fear of what the other ladies will say about her when she's out of the room. They don't like it there very much. They get defeated all the time. They get exposed quite often. They sort of got a bear by the tail. They can't destroy it. They can't control it. And they don't dare leave.
Well, having listened to you for the past few years, they must know that what you say to their face is just about as bad as what you're going to say behind their back. So there must be some other reason.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they hope that it's going to shift in their favor in the future.
Would you be happier if the Soviets were out of the UN?
Oh, that's a big question. I think at the moment there's a good deal of advantage in having them there, even though it is inconsistent to have a country there that disregards the Charter the way they do. But having them there has a certain value because it enables you to take some of these things that they say and expose them for the fallacies that they are.
Well, where is the consistency on your part, then, of wanting the Russian communists in and fighting so hard to keep the Chinese communists
out?
Well,
I can't throw the Russians out. Can't do it because they have the veto, and you can't expel a country without going through the Security Council, and they have a veto in the Security Council.
Well, are we to understand by that you would like to?
I would understand by that if the Soviet behavior in 1947 and 46 had been what it is now, they would never have been admitted.
And you would personally be happier, and you think that the world would be
better off if they were out? I'm a realist,
Mr.
Spivak. I make the best of things as they are. If the Russians are there, then I'm going to try to derive the greatest advantage from it.
But may I persist in this for just a minute, Mr. Ambassador? Do you think the world would be better off with the Russians out of the UN?
You can't tell.
Well, you've got to make a judgment.
I don't have to make a judgment because there isn't a chance in the world of throwing them out. If they were out all alone, without dragging a lot of other countries with them, that's one thing. If they went out and took a lot of other countries with them, that's another thing. You can't tell how it would come about. It depends on so many factors that you can't predict. What I do say is that if their behavior in 1946 has been what it's been since, they would never have been admitted.
Yeah, but you once said that you thought it was a good idea to have them in so you could watch them.
There are certain advantages in having them in, yes.
And I say again to you, where is the consistency of wanting them in and not allowing the Chinese communists in so that you can watch them?
Well, the consistency is that had their behavior been what it now is in 1946, they would not have been admitted in the first place. The Chinese communist behavior being what it is, they're not being admitted. The Russians now being in and it being impossible to throw them out, you make the best of having them there.
Mr. Balaraman.
Mr. Ambassador, less people voted for keeping China out during this session than they did in the past years. And I believe even Canada has told you that from next year on, she may have to change her attitude on this.
No, Canada has not told me that.
Oh, I read somewhere that Canada had served notice that this is the last time they are voting to keep China out.
No, I haven't heard that.
Do you think you will succeed in keeping China out indefinitely?
Regardless of the behavior of the Chinese communists?
Yes.
Oh, well, I think the behavior of the Chinese communists is should it change, that would be something of interest. I think if the behavior of the Chinese communists continues the way it is, I think we can keep them out.
What is this behavior the Chinese communists are talking about? They're not behaving any better than some of the other members in the UN at the
moment. Well, they're in flagrant defiance of the United Nations by their presence in Korea. They've been in a flagrant defiance of the United Nations Charter in North Vietnam and in Tibet, in the shelling of Quemoy, and a whole lot of other things. They've been officially declared by the United Nations General Assembly to be an aggressor. I don't know of any other country that has that questionable distinction.
But doesn't the UN become weaker because 600 million people are not represented on it?
I don't think so. I think the UN Charter says that a country to be a member shall be peace-loving, and I'm quoting those words. It doesn't say that it shall be a forum in which the law-abiding and the criminal shall be scrambled up indiscriminately. Well, now, you can't say that a regime that has been officially denounced as an aggressor by the General Assembly is peace-loving. And I think you just stultify the whole organization if you let them in, as long as they behave the way they do.
Miss Frederick.
Mr. Ambassador, is it realistic to expect that a nation like Red China, which has been rebuffed by the UN and denounced by it, would agree to observe the principles of the United Nations? Would it be natural to expect it to?
I think it's altogether proper. I don't know how natural it is that it's proper for the United Nations to insist on a certain standard of behavior of any regime that wants to be admitted. Yes, I do. I think you have to if you're going to keep faith with the Charter.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, as you have admitted yourself, nations which are already members of the United Nations have not lived up necessarily to that standard of behavior. The United Nations, as originally set up, was not supposed to be an exclusive club, as I understand it. And Secretary Dulles said in 1950, and I believe has reiterated it since, that the greatest weakness of the United Nations was lack of universal membership, that we ought to take nations in whether we believed what they did or not, that this was a place to discuss problems. Now, do you believe that this should be an exclusive club like NATO, where we have only our friends in, or should it be an organization to try to solve the world's problems, and therefore we take everybody in?
Ms. Frederick, what I think isn't very important. The important thing is, what does the Charter say? And the Charter says that members shall be, and I quote, peace-loving, unquote. And that confers on it a certain amount of exclusivity.
But you have already admitted that that interpretation has been stretched to cover a number of nations.
Not as far as admission is concerned, no. We have never admitted a country that has been officially proclaimed an aggressor by the United Nations.
But, Mr. Ambassador, it isn't a question of admission. It's a question of representation.
That's
China
right.
is a member.
That's right.
And it's a question of recognizing the credentials of the Chinese representatives from Peking.
Well, it's more than credentials. It's a question of admitting a regime that has been officially denounced as an aggressor, and we've never done that in the United Nations.
Well, then how can you be consistent with the way we treat Hungary? We have denounced Hungary, but when it comes to ousting the Hungarian representation from the United Nations, we say, no, let's not take any action. So the Hungarians sit there, debate, and vote, just the same as any other member. Now, where is the consistency in our
attitude? Well, the two things are entirely different, because the Hungarians are there and the Chinese communists are not.
Mr. Lindley.
In 1952, you were pre-convention and convention manager of the Eisenhower for President movement. Looking forward to 1960, who in your judgment as an experienced Republican politician would be the strongest Republican nominee for the presidency?
Well, Mr. Lindley, I'm in a foreign policy job. I'm carrying out United States foreign policy and trying to do it in a nonpartisan manner. And I think that as long as I'm in this job, I'd better not talk domestic politics.
Well, I didn't ask you whether you thought the Republican ought to be elected. I was trying to keep it nonpartisan, but I was asking you as an experienced observer who, in your judgment, would be the strongest Republican nominee.
Well, I think I'm going to have to stand on that answer, because I think it's out of keeping
yeah.
for me in the foreign policy
Do you think the nomination of Vice President Nixon for the presidency is a foregone conclusion?
Well, I've just told you what I think, what my position ought to be on those questions.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Ambassador, the Times recently wrote that the outstanding development of the current session of the UN is not to be found in any decisions that you took, but in the uncompromising position taken by the Soviet Union, and this is the important thing, and the increasing support it is now receiving from countries calling themselves uncommitted. Would you say that this appraisal of our weakening position in the UN is an accurate one?
No, I don't think so. I don't think our position in the UN is a weakening one. You have a lot of new countries that are coming into nationhood and that are coming into the United Nations. To me, it's better to have them in the United Nations than to have them out of the United Nations. Of course, it means that we have to go out and make a case on everything. We have to go out and persuade people. We haven't got a situation where there are a lot of countries that always vote with us just as a matter of routine. But I don't think that's necessarily a weak thing.
Well,
I think it's probably a good thing for us.
Well, isn't it true?
And it still holds true. We haven't been defeated on a single major question.
Well, isn't it true, though, that the number of abstaining votes and the increasing vote against the things we stand for have been considerable?
Well, there are certain parts of the world where things that interest us don't interest them. The Korean question never interested the Arab world as much as it did us. The world is still a big place. And the fact that the number of people abstain on issues that interest us is no more serious than the fact that we abstain on issues that interest them.
I know, but even
I mean, you're bound to have some of that.
Even on the matter of admitting communist China, if we had to get a two-thirds vote of the 82, we'd be in serious trouble. We'd need 54 votes, and I think all
we
you
wouldn't
were
be in any more trouble than the people would be in who would be trying to throw out the nationalists by a two-thirds vote.
Yes, but you've been only able to muster about 44 votes this last time, a decline, as
that was
I remember, at 48.
It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to keep on declining. There are reasons for those votes. I can't remember what they are now, but they were not connected with the merits of the question.
You think, though, that you've stopped the decline, and you say that
I
our
think we might very well get a better vote next year.
And you think that the influence of the United States and the UN has not declined this last year?
I think we've got lots of influence in the UN.
That wasn't the question, Mr. Ambassador. The question was, is our influence declining in the UN?
Well, every time we've put it to the test, we've been successful. So I wouldn't say it had declined.
Mr. Ballaramon.
Sir, the president of the assembly the other day said that this complete diplomatic deadlock in the world is because technology has outstripped diplomacy. In the old days, when two countries sat down to negotiate, there was always a fear of war if negotiations failed. Now, war means destruction for all, and this fear no longer exists. What is diplomacy to do to overcome this blank wall and compel negotiators to reach some sort of agreement?
Well, there's got to be in the world a commonly held idea of right and wrong and of justice. And as long as you have this world communist movement, you're not going to have a generally held sense of fair play. I think if you removed the communist world, the rest of the world does have the same sense of fair play. Now, that's only going to come about through education and evolution. And until the communist world catches up with the rest of us, why you're going to have these deadlocks? I don't see any way of avoiding it. Because to adhere to Karl Marx in 1956 is, of course, a backward-looking kind of philosophy. And they still do it. And that's going to produce deadlocks.
Ms. Frederick.
Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Hammarskjöld has gone to the Middle East to try to shore up that shaky armistice again. Do you think it'd be a good idea to ask for his services to try to do something about the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union?
Well, I think you'd have to get it more detail than you put it. I don't know just how he'd go about it. I think the Cold War between us and the Soviet Union is not due to a misunderstanding. I think it's due to radically different ways of looking at the world. I don't think it's the kind of thing that can be worked out by a clever diplomat like the Secretary General going there and trying to clear up some misunderstandings. It's a radically different way of looking at life and of looking at the world. So I wouldn't think that any individual diplomat, no matter how clever, and Secretary General is a very clever man, could be expected to solve that.
Mr. Lindley.
In view of what you've just said, Mr. Ambassador, do you see any specific area in which there might be an accommodation or a field of cooperation between the Soviet Union and the United States?
Oh, yes. I think that there are some cultural activities which can be successful. And I still think we ought to try to get political and diplomatic agreements on things that are self-enforcing, like the withdrawal of troops from Austria, for instance. That was quite successful. I believe they've made a little headway at Geneva on the conference on cessation of nuclear tests. I think you ought to keep on trying all the time, because you never can tell when there may not be a break. And you must not be easily discouraged.
Mr. Ambassador, on that note of hope, I think we'll have to interrupt. I see that our time is up. Thank you very much, Ambassador Lodge, for being with us.
And Monitor's thanks to Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, Chief of U.S. Delegation to the United Nations, and to the members of the Meet the Press panel for a stimulating and enlightening half hour. The interrogators were Ernest Lindley of Newsweek magazine, Pauline Frederick of NBC News, Krishna Balaraman of the newspaper Hindu of India, and Larry Spivak of Meet the Press.
You may not be aware of it, but there's an army on the march today in your community. Its soldiers walk softly and quickly through the shadowed streets of your town. They may be 500 strong or only 4 or 5. But whatever their number, they are working around the clock to make this a truly happy Christmas for the lonely, the homeless, the neglected, the weary, and discouraged. They are the Salvation Army, dedicated men and women who wear the familiar red-trimmed blue uniform. Working in partnership with them, you can share your holiday happiness with those who have so little.